All right. Hello. Today is December 16th, 2020, and I am sitting here with Gladys Attrill. How are you doing today?
I'm well, Ryan. Thank you. How about you?
Good. Thanks.
Good.
So I will start right at the beginning. Can you tell me where and when you were born?
I was born on October 16, 1959. I was born in Prince George, but was there only for a few days and have otherwise been in Smithers, you know, with some comings and goings, but basically all my life.
Okay, sure. Can you tell me a little bit about your family?
My family is very small, my immediate family, mom and dad, so I was an only child. And my dad was James Thomas Attrill, and he was born at the Rinch Hospital in Hazleton. And now, if I don't get that date wrong, November 2nd, 1927. And my mother was the name she was born with, my best pronunciation, is Sylvia Kshenska. She was born in Lublin, Poland, and February 8th, 1916.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit more about your parents? What did they do for a job? How did they end up in the Valley?
Okay. I'll start with my dad. So my dad, of course, one of the Attrill family, and there is a place on Highway 16 west of Whitsett or Morristown that was known when I was growing up as Attrill Corner, and there's a property there more recently, and I'm not sure if it's still this, was Bernie's Custom Auto, and there's a small house on, I guess, if your one is driving toward Terrace, on the right-hand side of the road, and an old barn, and that is the old Attrill property. My dad was one of 12 siblings, and his parents came to the Valley very early. They rode horses across the country from Manitoba, and I don't know the details of how they ended up in what was known as Seton. And anyway, they carved a niche for themselves on that piece of property and raised their family there. And so my dad was there until he was a young man and just came to Smithers, which of course is not so far, and did different types of work, sort of handyman work, carpentry work, and eventually signed on with the railroad, where he had a career for, if my memory serves me right, about 33 or 34 years with the railroad. And then retired here, lived between Smithers and Susqua, and later days just around the valley, Hazleton, Grand Isle, and back to Smithers. And he passed away in 2007. So my mom, born in Lublin, but her family lived in Krakow. So, some of her earlier family history, I don't remember. So she was, of course, born during the First World War. Her father passed away when she was quite young, just 2 years old, and her mother remarried. So my mom had one full brother and a half-sister from her mother's second marriage. And I think my mom's early life was quite happy. She lived in Krakow, which is toward the south of Poland, and much time in a resort area, Zakopane, which she talked about fondly. And then, of course, she was a young woman when the Second World War began. And through circumstances that are not 100% clear to me, she ended up scooped up in the middle of one night. She was Polish Catholic, not a Jew, but Polish Catholic, but was scooped up and taken away and spent several years at Dachau in Germany during the war. And so after the war, she spoke fondly of the Liberation Day at Dachau and always had a soft spot in her heart for the American people. And was taken in by a German family in Bavaria near Munich, where Dachau is near, and so also had a very soft spot for the German people. And I was there until 1948, when through the process that was available, came to Canada, and with some other Polish girls, boarded a ship in Hamburg, disembarked in Quebec, was put on a train, and got off the train in Smithers, where there was a Catholic hospital. And she lived at what was then the nurse's residence, is currently Passage House, but it was the hospital was run by the Sisters of St. Anne. And so she was there. My dad was one of the maintenance workers. And so she met my dad, and they were married in 1949. So it's a bit of history.
Okay, great. I guess, what else did they do for work, when you were growing up?
So my parents had been married for, I think, about 10 years. And again, I don't recall the circumstances, but weren't able to have children. And so then entered an adoption process. I was an adopted child. And at that time, so got notice of a child and born in Prince George. So they came and retrieved me from Prince George. That's why I was only there for a few days. And then Smithers was my home. From my earliest recollection, my dad had already started working on the railroad. And my mom had worked at the hospital because that's where she was brought to when she came to Canada. It's kind of an interesting sidebar, if I may, with the more recent refugee process that Canada had in bringing, you know, folks in the last few years, an accelerated program for people from Syria, etc. And sometime, I think it was maybe just before my mom died or just after, I went through her papers just to make sure everything was in order. Yes, it was before she died. I wanted to make sure everything was in order. And included in what I found was a letter from the government of Canada 1 year after she had come to Canada. And it was, you know, it's an old typewritten letter. And it said to her that, you know, thank you for fulfilling your obligation to Canada. And now you are free to do as you please. If you choose to leave Canada, we wish you well. If you choose to stay, we wish you well. And it was just this lovely letter. And at the time, I was involved with some other folks in a sponsorship program to bring someone to Canada. And it struck me that, you know, the times are different, but Canada, even in the late 40s, was welcoming people from other places. And, you know, sometimes those refugee programs cause angst for people, and we see folks that don't think they're the right thing to do. But it affirmed for me what a right thing to do it is, that where we have the good fortune in this country, that we can afford to invite others and treat them well. And it just made me feel good to be a part of something where we were trying to assist someone else to have a home in this beautiful place that we make home. Anyway, that is a bit of a sidebar, but it was one of the things that I discovered about my mother. So when I was a child, my mom was home mostly, and my dad was working on the railroad. You know, the railroad, I think, was different in those days. I mean, the railroad's been significant to Smithers for the non-Indigenous people since the get-go, because, of course, we are a town that was laid out by the Grand Trunk Pacific Railroad. And so I think, you know, it always seemed kind of interesting that my dad was on the trains and he would go overnight to stay away, come home, be back for a day. That was kind of the route he was on. And my mom was home most of the time. My parents broke up when I was quite young. I think I was about, well, I know I was about 7 when they separated. So life was different. After that, I lived with my mother. My dad was close by, but things were different at that point. So my mom started going to work again sometime thereafter. I don't recall exactly when, but she did different sorts of jobs, but also reconnected with the hospital and worked there as well.
Okay, great. And you never had any siblings or anything?
No okay. Siblings. Just
an only child. Whereabouts did you grow up? Like, what sort of neighborhood in Smithers?
Well, Smithers is very small, so I can tell you precisely. When I was born, my parents had a house on 8th Avenue or Hospital Street. And the house is gone, but the property is directly behind the Fireweed Motel, directly behind that. And the house that my dad built is gone. Another house was moved to that site. After that, my dad built a house on the highway. It is still there, and it's just toward town from the motel. My memory is leaving me, the Sorrento. It's had That's different great. Names. So that house that was made famous by Mark Perry in his song, The White House. So I lived there, and then my mom later bought a house on 2nd Avenue, not too far from where the college is. And by then I was an adult and carried on with my own dwellings.
Okay, great. I guess, what was it like growing up in Smithers? Like, if you can remember elementary school age, what was that like?
Well, it is hard to remember those things. It does seem like a while ago. I went to St. Joseph's School. My mom was Catholic, and so I went to the Catholic school and we attended the Catholic church. And so from the house on the highway, I do remember the first day of school. My memory is that my mom walked me to school on the first day, which seemed an incredible long distance in this mysterious route. And then after that, I walked on my own. And I remember, I think it was the second day, thinking, well, I'll never get there. I have no idea where it is. I'm going to be lost forever. So it was quite traumatic. But of course, I did get there and I got home it was not that bad, but it seemed very far from the highway to where St. Joseph's School is. You know, and in those days, Smithers did look different. There weren't the neighborhoods that are there now. So when one was walking in that part of town, the current high school didn't exist. Those were fields owned by the Booker family. And you walked through, you know, Smithers is that famous swamp, and there was still remnants of that. And when one was walking to school, you know, it was quite interesting. There were wet places and, you know, fallen trees and bush, and quite fun, really. You know, like, it was an exciting place. You could easily be distracted. Lots of places to play. And then our neighbors were the Bookers, and they had lots of rural property, and all the kids in the neighborhood had, you know, lots of places where we could just be gone. You know, there was still swampland and undeveloped land, which is now the Silver King subdivision. That was kind of our extended backyard. So as kids, I mean, it was lots of fun. And of course, there was no technology, so no one could get you. You couldn't be texted or recalled in any particular way. So in the summer, when kids would go out to play, we just go out to play. And I think we probably had guidelines like, you know, when you're hungry or when it's dark or something like that, because it just seemed like we had that amazing freedom to just go goof around in the bush or by the creeks and the swamps. And it was a lot of fun.
Sure. What about when you got a little bit older, got into high school? What was that like?
Well, I remember both what was junior high school. So the Chandler Park School that is now, of course, derelict, was the junior high school when I went to school. And I recall junior high school and high school as being, you know, both interesting. How do I say this? I don't think I found school terribly hard, and I can't say I was terribly interested. The other parts of school were interesting to me, both the social life. I've always been involved, and so starting from Chandler Park, you know, I was involved in student council and kind of things that were happening in the school. And then I went to Chandler Park for grades 8, 9, and 10. So I only went to the high school, and that school's not here anymore either. The high school I went to is on the same property that the college is on now. So that was the high school. So for me, I lived like 150 meters from the high school. So it was pretty easy in that regard. But in high school, you know, I had started working by then. I had a part-time job, and life was already becoming more interesting outside of school. So, you know, it was fun. I don't know how interesting it was. I was, you know, probably a fairly average teenager. I was way more interested in the social things and the people that I knew and the new friends that I was making through work than fully applying myself to high school. I would have to say that.
Okay. And what did you do for a job, a part-time job?
Well, I think I was one of many who was employed by Good Acres. I worked at the Super Value store. They hired me when I was in grade 10, and I worked for Good Acres until after I graduated high school. And then I started a summer job originally with what was then the BC Forest Service, working on survey crews. And my memory is I did that while I went to SAIT for post-secondary. So I was doing that in the summer as well, when I went to SAIT. So yeah, it was so that I think working for Good Acres, you know, it makes you feel like you're part of a club now at my age. Many of us did. They hired lots of folks, and it was, you know, it was a job where they expected you to do well and to do your job well. But at the same time, it did provide a really big extended social circle, and it feels lucky to have worked for them.
Great. You mentioned other social things outside of work. What else did you do outside of school as a teenager?
Well, as a younger teen, I was involved in, you know, some of the sporting activities that were school as well. I stopped those when I started working. So, you know, as someone who lived with a single parent, money was always important. And as a teenager, I wanted money just like anyone else. And the way that I could get money was by working, and that became my priority. So I wanted to work as much as I could in order to have money to do the things I wanted. And so I stopped doing, I think by the time I got to high school, I don't really recall being involved in extracurricular at school. After school, I went to work and I worked on the weekends. But, you know, you meet people and things that I did enjoy. I had a nice circle of friends and we spent time exploring. We went on kind of funny camping trips and hiking trips and just kind of enjoying where we lived. I was lucky that way to have a group of friends that enjoyed that, you know, so spent time on just funny trails that we'd find, you know, that other people already knew existed, but we thought we'd found them for the very first time. And so did a little bit of hiking in the Babine Mountains and just to other places that we thought we discovered.
Okay, great. And so you mentioned that you went to SAIT.
Yes.
Southern Alberta Institute of Technology,
that's right.
Okay. What did you study there?
In those days, it was called Television, Stage, and Radio Arts. So, and as we went through, I settled into radio. That's what I did. So that was the portion that I enjoyed.
And why did you decide to go into radio?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I can't really put myself in my brain back then. You know, I think I was 18 when I went to SAIT. Somehow broadcast had always, well, probably not always, but for enough time prior to making the decision had appealed to me. And I looked up various schools. So the two schools that I think I hoped for most were either BCIT in Vancouver or SAIT in Calgary. And I was able to get an interview for SAIT, and I got an acceptance letter before I think I even got an interview for BCIT, so I was content to go to SAIT. But why exactly I chose it, I've just forgotten that. Interestingly enough, there is a teacher that I had who is still here, Allison Candela, and she told me afterwards that we had spoken when she was doing counseling, the student counseling, of course, to help kids make those decisions. And she had said, we had talked about it then. I have forgotten that, but she had reminded me. So I must have had that interest even in school to go that way. But it was a lot of fun going to say it was fun. It was, you know, an accelerated learning. It was long hours, again, new people. It was just very, very exciting. I loved it a lot.
How was it like to move from, you know, small town northern BC to Calgary at that age?
Well, it was fun. You know, there was some angst, I think, because as well, I was the only child of a mom who was a bit older. You know, there was a little bit of that. It felt, you know, abandoning is probably too big a word, but in that way, you know, I felt a bit guilty about being gone. At the same time, I was embarking on a new part of my life. I had a boyfriend and he moved with me and we started our life there, and, you know, and school was fantastic and Calgary was booming at that time. It was growing at this crazy rate. It had the feeling that, you know, at sometimes you'd go into school in the morning and the road you used in the morning wasn't there at night. And it was just, so it was exciting, you know, for someone coming from a small town like Smithers into a city that was thriving and having to figure out my way. Yeah, it was lots of fun. I mean, definitely enjoyed it. I was applied and interested there, unlike high school.
Okay, great. I just want to go back something else I was just thinking of. So you mentioned your mother was Polish, right?
Yes.
Did you have any sort of, like, I guess, unique traditions or anything at home? Or was the Polish language used at all?
No, sadly. My mother, I think, like many immigrants at that time, was, you know, more concerned about using English. Also, my dad spoke English, so he didn't speak Polish. My mom had Polish friends, so we would go to the homes of other Polish people, and they would converse in Polish, but I would hang out with the kids, and we'd all speak in English. So, you know, when I was a child, I had a few words. Honestly, I have no words anymore. I went to Poland a few years ago, and I had to learn how just to say, you know, hello, goodbye, thank you, some key words. It was quite humiliating. But traditions, you know, I think a lot of them were built. There weren't many, but they were built around the things that she enjoyed most growing up. And they tended to be around religious holidays. I mean, Poland was a very Catholic country. And so, you know, those church holidays were quite significant, Easter and Christmas. You know, Christmas was more the European way. So a live tree, of course, was put up. And it was a blend of traditions. We would, you know, gifts were on Christmas Eve, and it was in my mind now is quite a blur of, you know, the gifts that the baby Jesus brought versus the gifts that Santa Claus brought, because there was all of that mixed together. So somehow they merged those. But we always had the special dinner on Christmas Eve, a fish dinner, a light dinner, quite lovely. And then for some of my childhood and early teens, I would go to midnight mass. And then on Christmas Day, a different sort of dinner. And as I got older, then that became the gift day too, you know, traditions blur. But I think the piece of the dinner on Christmas Eve was always quite special. It was always the same food or the same type of food. My mom was a good cook, so the food was always lovely and light. You know, it was fish and salads. And my mom was not a big dessert person, but always on Christmas was poppy seed cake, which was Polish tradition. So I think that, and then Easter, you know, new clothes and being dressed up, well for Easter Sunday, and that was a big day, a big celebratory day. I don't remember doing different things at home, but it was the attitude of the day that that was a really important day.
Okay, great. And you mentioned spending time with other Polish families. Was there some sort of community in the area?
Yeah, so my mom was good friends with the Depkas who were in Telkwa. And so there were three families. I'm just going to stretch my memory. Three families. There was Wanda and Ted Depka and their children. And then Christine and I believe Richard Depka and their kids. And then on Round Lake. Oh, you know, I'm losing the name. I think it was Steve Depka, and I can't remember Mrs. Depka's name. Because, of course, as a child, they were all Mr. and Mrs. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to store their first names. But, yes, so we would go often and visit, particularly the family of Wanda Depka. Wanda and my mom were friends, or Wanda. And so spent time there, for sure, back and forth between households.
Okay, great. So I want to move on and talk about some employment and things like that. But sure. Before I do that, is there anything else about childhood, teenagers, or anything that you wanted to bring up?
No, nothing. I guess just the sensation, you know, and maybe this is coming, you know, with the point of aging is I think one of the great joys of childhood when I was little was freedom. You know, it's not that we weren't told things like, you know, be careful, don't talk to strangers, all those rules that your parents give you. But at the same time, it was a different era. And I think we had a lot of freedom. You know, as kids, we could ride our bikes to the lake. We could go play in the bush. We could hang out. You know, I had a favorite as a young teen. I had a favorite little walking trail just up a little ways up on Hudson Bay Mountain. I'm not sure I could find it now, but I liked to read and I would take myself after school and just walk up this trail to this little outcrop and read my book for a while, you know, and you weren't connected to anyone. And so, you know, of course something could have gone wrong, but obviously nothing went wrong. You went and you enjoyed yourself and you came home when you were ready. And so I do think that freedom and independence was very special, and I feel very fortunate to have had it. It would have been completely different if your mother could have texted you to find out where you are. You know, that notion that now I've walked out of the yard, I've said where I'm going, maybe I'm going there, maybe I'm not, but I have this time to do what I want to do. And then for the most part, you know, it works out just fine. You come home and have dinner and you do your homework. But yeah, I think that notion of freedom, of really just being able to go and to play or to hang out with your friends in a really untethered way was probably the piece when I view the connectivity now, which is so good in so many ways. I don't mean to suggest it's not, but being untethered is quite lovely.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that for sure. Okay, so I'm going to move on to some questions about employment, because I think you've worked in a few different industries, a lot of different things. So you mentioned Good Acres already. What was next?
So let's see. So I worked for Good Acres until I was through school. And then I was lucky. I felt very lucky. I got a job, a summer job with the BC Forest Service. And that was with a survey crew, road survey crew. And it was just fun. You know, you meet new people and we would work in different parts of this district. And so often we would leave Monday morning and go to someplace exciting, like maybe even Topley. And we'd stay in a motel and we'd be there for 5 days and be working in the bush on whatever road development project was coming up. So, you know, we were never that far, but it was fun. You know, you're with your crew and getting great exercise every day, working in the bush, walking and, you know, taking direction on how to lay out roads and back. So it was a lot of fun. And so I got to also see different parts of the bush landscape around here, because that's what the job was. You know, you're out going to the end point of the road and then walking to as far as you could survey and then walking back. And the next day you'd walk a little further, just the nature of how it was done then. So it was quite fun. And, you know, I was able to see kind of, you know, maybe backcountry is too strong a word, but close in backcountry around Smithers, the Bulkley Valley, and then out in the Lakes District, a little bit around Terrace. We did one job up in Deese Lake. So it was a really nice learning of the landscape as I was a young, you know, a teenager, I guess a later teen into my early 20s, actually seeing that part of the world, like from the ground up. So, you know, your feet are on the ground all day. And, you know, I was always interested in plants. So it's like you could snack on the wild food you found and, you know, you'd see animals. And it was a great job. You know, it was healthy and a nice crew and learning, you know, about the countryside in a very basic way. Yeah, nice, healthy exercise every day. So that was a great job. And then I worked, I'm not sure why I changed. I worked one summer with BC Parks, which was also kind of fun, just a labor job, cleaning up parks, Tyee Lake and out to Seeley Lake and Babine. So that was fun, different crew. And then by then I was through at SAIT and I applied at what was then known as BVLD Radio. And I was hired on in the newsroom, so I worked there. My memory is going to leave me now. Not that long, actually, a couple years maybe. And it was also, this will date me as well, but for folks who have seen WKRP in Cincinnati, there were a lot of similarities. So in that small building that houses the radio station now, the Moose, I mean, we had, I think, 24, 25 people working in that building. It was the era of live radio. And the newsroom had five people in it. There were disc jockeys, real people on the air from 6 a.m. through the evening, different crews on the weekends, the copywriting, the traffic department, everything was in that building, sales. So it was a pretty fun place. It was chaotic. But, you know, at the same time, you had an expectation that you were going to be on the air when you were supposed to be, and it was live radio. So if you made a mistake, you made it real. You know, again, met people, one of whom is still a close friend today, he doesn't live here anymore, but we worked together and that friendship lasted. So yeah, it was kind of, it was a fun job. And after that, one of the ladies who worked at the radio station at the time, Marianne Delwish, she and her husband owned a travel agency on Main Street, and she knew that I was a little unhappy where I was working. And she said, why don't you work for us? So I left the radio station and moved over to what was then Uniglobe Glenmar Travel and learned about the travel industry. And Marianne was sort of an influence in my life for a while. She had been a copywriter and a salesperson at BVLD Radio. And then she moved to CJFW Radio. At that time, it was Skeena Broadcasters. And they were coming into the Bulkley Valley and had opened a station here, CJFW. And they were a couple of years down the road looking to open a mini newsroom. And so Marianne, even though I was working for her and her husband, came over to me and she said, you know what, you should do this. You should move over. And somehow she set up a radio. She was kind of like my agent. And she set up an interview with someone. And then I moved over to CJFW as the sort of one person news department here. And I did that, man, for a few years. I actually don't remember how long anymore. But that got me back connected with many things in the community. That is the one thing, working in news. You have the right and the authority to phone people and ask them questions. And so it's a great learning about community. I was very fortunate, I think, in both working in the newsroom at BVLD and at CJFW, the learning about community. You know, we did have beats in those days. So when I was at BVLD, I had a council beat. And so I went to council meetings, not all of them, but, you know, a lot in Smithers, but also in Telqua. I went to council meetings in New Hazleton and Hazleton. I had the opportunity to attend regional district meetings. And, you know, you talk to the police about what's going on in the police files. So you have a real different learning about community. What's going on? What are the stories? And when you phone people, they just talk to you. It's magic. So I felt very fortunate for that. And I felt that I got a good education, a basic education about how things work in the Valley. I was able to, early on, you know, the complexity of the relationship between the Indigenous people and the non-Indigenous people in our valley is prominent. You know, that's a big thing for us to sort out. And in my young days with BVLD Radio, I had the opportunity to talk with people who were heavily engaged in what was then the Gitxsan Carrier Tribal Council, became the Gitxsan Wet'suwet'en Tribal Council, was able to go to their conventions and meet people and talk to them. You know, I was around when the Delgamuukw case was filed. I was able to sit in the courtroom for the 3 weeks that that trial was here. So the education afforded to one who has the privilege of acting as a reporter is amazing. You get access to people, they speak to you, and it just is this amazing baseline education that I still feel like I benefit from. Plus the knowledge that if you call people up and you ask them things, sometimes they'll just tell you. So it still affords me that confidence to phone people up when I'm curious about something or I feel there's a struggle in information that, you know, people are quite generous. If there's nothing nefarious in your intention and you phone them up, they'll probably just talk to you.
Great. So I have two questions that came from that.
Okay.
What was this case that you mentioned that was 3 weeks long, you said?
Oh, so it's one of the landmark cases in Canada in our dealings with the Indigenous people. So the case is known as Delgamuukw. And I will forget the date of settlement. It was a long time in the courts, but Delgamuukw is still a case that is referred to as we move forward in Canada in how we, you know, reconcile with Indigenous people. How do we figure our way forward? And that case, the first days of that case were heard in the courthouse in Smithers. You know, the plaintiffs were here. And it was astonishing to be there for a while. The case moved to Vancouver eventually for the length of it. But, you know, it affirms again that every place in the country is significant. This is a significant community, and the people who live here have worth and matter just the same as anywhere else. And sometimes in a small town, we forget that. But important decisions are made here that affect the rest of the country as well. And Delgamuukw was one of those.
Great, thank you. This one is more of a side tangent. So when you were a young adult, working in the radio, working for the travel agency in town, what did you do for fun then? Like, how did that change from when you were a teenager?
Well, I always liked the outdoors. You know, and I think my life has been one of just sort of falling into good luck a lot of times without a lot of really deep planning. As a teenager, there was a neighbor to my mother's house when we lived on 2nd Avenue, Ray Wick. He still lives here. And Ray was very outdoorsy. And, you know, I think he saw a teenager who perhaps could use just a little direction. And he suggested I buy some cross-country skis, and I did, and he got them going for me. In those days, you put pine tar on the bases, and he kind of got me going skiing. And so that was cool. And then I had family friends, the Sickus family. Patty Sickus and I were friends, and her family were downhill skiers. And so they carved a niche out for me to learn how to downhill ski. And then Ray Wick, the same neighbor, was also a canoeist, and he kind of, you know, led me down that path as well. And so fairly young, in my early 20s, my boyfriend, then husband, and I took some canoe lessons. I became a canoe instructor. And that charted a path for me, a career path, or part of a career path. So it's not something I really thought I would do. But once I started doing it, I liked it. And I was able to develop skills at it to become, you know, I was good at it. And so then I started teaching canoeing and eventually, you know, became part of a business where we were offering guided canoe trips. So I ended up, you know, being part of a team that took people on trips into the Spatsy's East of Keene, some trips into the Yukon, one magical trip into the Northwest Territories. So canoeing, teaching canoeing, and being in the outdoors became a big part of my career. The company was Northern Sun Tours. Still exists, although just a fraction. I mean, time has gone by. Those things are now part of my history. They're not part of my active life. But being able to be in the outdoors was sort of amazing. So time skiing, time canoeing, and then turning that into a bit of a vocation. So working, teaching people how to do things. There was a program at what was then Northwest Community College called the Wilderness Guiding Skills Program, originally initiated by a group called the Skeena Air Guides. They wanted to ensure that their guides had some skills, some basic skills. They could teach them what they really needed to know out in the bush, but they needed to have a little bit of first aid, you know, a little bit of kind of what was called guide-client relations, knowing how to get along with people. And that grew into a bigger program called the Wilderness Guiding Skills Program. And the man that really led that was a fellow who was still here, Bob Henderson. He had a guide territory up in Tatlatui and was part of the Skeena Air Guides and became the man behind the Wilderness Guiding Skills Program. And so through, you know, little opportunity to bigger opportunity, I became involved with the Wilderness Guide Skills Program and taught there for about 20 years. And it was a short program. So the Wilderness Guide Skills Program was originally a 30-day program, and it grew eventually to a 90-day program. It was residential. So the students would come and they would live in a camp, and the instructional staff would go to that camp every day and do our part, whatever the skills that we were involved in. And so it grew from something that was fairly small. The first thing I ever taught for the Wilderness Guides Program, I think, was a CPR course. And near the end, I mean, we were working for 60 or 90 days in this program, delivering various skills, which was really about getting people out, you know, allowing people to pursue their love of the outdoors, hoping that it would connect them with a love for people and teaching. And that blend was the Wilderness Guides Program. So that was pretty amazing. So that was about 20 years. But not every day that was the program when it ran. And then, you know, for a part of my life, then I was doing different guiding functions during the summer, sort of teaching our company. We called it, you know, outdoor recreation and education. So we would just build a schedule. It was only two people. You just build a schedule to keep you busy, hope that you're able to sell all of your programs, and then figure out what you were going to do next. And, you know, I managed to find other work to kind of supplement that. So this is back to, you know, sometimes it wasn't really good management and strategizing on my part. It's just things tended to come up, and keep your eyes open and be willing to try something. And I had all kinds of amazing opportunities without a lot of real tough career planning.
Great. So was a lot of this Northern Sun Tours?
Northern Sun Tours.
Was this kind of, I guess, kind of at the same time you were doing some of the radio stuff afterwards?
No, afterwards. I think okay. I left, let me see. At the beginning, there would have been some of it going on. Certainly the canoe instruction, teaching canoeing started, you know, in the early 80s. I think I became certified as a canoe instructor in 1981 or something like that. And I finally left CGFW, kind of the last full-time job, I think about 1992. So I was blending things for a while, trying to figure out, you know, take a holiday in order to do something else, you know, kind of filling all the days. It was fun to do. And then in 1992, I left the radio station and took a part-time job with the Steelhead Society of BC, which had an office here. They were working on a campaign called the Wild Steelhead Campaign. It was really one of the most amazing jobs they ever had. It was just me in an office above Calderwoods, you know, writing newsletters, contacting people for donations for fundraising, writing minutes of meetings. But it was also working with people who were so passionate and dedicated to what they were trying to do, which was about salmon and steelhead. And this is a tangent to what you asked me, but, you know, these moments in time change us. And even though my job for the Wild Steelhead Campaign was really just keeping the office together, when I don't have spectacular office skills, but working with people that care so deeply about species and river and how do we ensure that we have those into the future affected me to my core. There's a story about a fellow who's now passed away. He lived in Terrace, Bruce Hill, and he was a big behemoth of a man, a big man. And he came into the office one day to see, you know, kind of what I was doing. And he just told this story about catching a steelhead. And I'm not an angler. I don't fish. I never did. So I didn't have any personal experience at it. But I was sitting at my desk, and this man who was, you know, originally from California, had a bit of a, you know, U.S. California accent, and a big logger of a guy talking to me about what it is like to put that line in the water and connect with a life form, this amazing life form that has swam down the river and out into the ocean, and through some instinct made its way back to this same river of its birth. And then you connect with it on the end of a line. And if you're lucky, you bring it in and you touch it. And this fellow had tears coming from his eyes as he described the first time he touched. It was a female steelhead. He called it a hen. And, you know, just feeling this energy connect, life form to life form, and how important it was to make sure we protected it. And that never left me. His story never left me. You know, and I think it's part of what I reflect on, being able to work out in the bush when I was younger, then being able to take people out into the bush when I was older, whether it was on a river trip or, you know, helping in the mountains. But there is a connectivity with your bare feet on the ground that is really important. And I just feel really lucky that I had those experiences and that I was able in some way to share them with others. And now at this point, I don't even remember what you asked me. I've gone on my own tangent.
Oh, this is great. You kind of have continued the story about employment and things. So this is great. Yeah. So, working for the Steelhead Society.
Yes, it was a very, I don't even remember how long. It was not a long job. You know, if I was there, I probably wasn't there 2 years. And then, because I was always trying to piece together my employment so that I could keep doing the things I wanted to do. So the guiding job was really lots of fun, but it's not terribly lucrative. So at some point you also had to figure out, well, how am I going to get enough money that I can pay all my bills? And a part-time job came up at the college, and I was teaching the guide school for the college, although that was on contract. A part-time job in what was continuing ed came up, and I thought, well, maybe I can make this work. So I was fortunate, and I was hired by the college in this continuing ed position. And I did it for a couple of years, but it didn't really work. My primary interest was always being able to do what I want. And I wanted still to teach at the guide school, and I wanted to be able to do the outdoor experiences. And at some point, it was just too tight, and I couldn't do them all, and I left the college. So I think I was only there for about 2 years. And what did I do after? Then I stayed with sort of the outdoor experience stuff for quite a while. Oh, and I know. So then this is the happenstance, right? The town of Smithers had hired a consultant, Greg Meredith, to look at tourism in the town and see what were the opportunities for developing tourism, for marketing tourism. The town of Smithers was one of the first in British Columbia to become a collector of what then was known as the hotel tax. So there were 8 communities in BC in the early 90s that got together. You know, the hotel association, hoteliers and communities figured we need to do something to support the tourism sector and we need some money for marketing. And they came up with a scheme where they would add an additional tax on their guests at their rooms. And that tax could be used for tourism promotion in British Columbia. And Smithers was an early signatory, well, one of the first signatories. And so this money started to flow from the hotel tax. And Smithers, the town of Smithers, was a shareholder in the Smithers Ski Corporation. And so the money that was generated by hotel tax was able to support the Smithers Ski Corp because the town was a shareholder to assist with the marketing and keeping the ski hill operation successful. At some point, and I don't recall the year, the town of Smithers divested itself of the Ski Corp, but was still a recipient of the hotel tax. And so this money was accumulating. Some of it was used for some smaller marketing campaigns in conjunction with the Chamber of Commerce, which operates the visitor center. But the town decided to take a better look at it and see what could we do. They hired Greg to write what was called a winter tourism strategy. And one of the recommendations was to hire someone on contract to tackle winter marketing. And Greg gave me a call and said, hey, this is going to be coming up. You might want to think about it. So I did, and I applied for this contract work. And in 1999, I think I was hired as the contractor to do that work. I'm still doing that work in the background. So that was a part-time contract. It still is. And, you know, it was about developing what is now Tourism Smithers as a marketing entity for Smithers and trying to support the tourism sector. You know, we've had some really good times. We've had some bad times, and we're living certainly through one of the worst times right now for tourism during the pandemic. And so it's interesting to have seen it, you know, kind of ebb and flow over the years, how connected this little community in, you know, North Central British Columbia is to the rest of the world. When something happens in the world, it affects us. You know, when SARS happened, it mattered. If they stopped coming to Canada, they stopped coming to British Columbia, they stopped coming to Smithers. So all these things that seemed so distant in so many ways affected us immediately. And the pandemic is just the big exclamation mark on those. It's affecting the entire world. And we're a part of that. So the tourism industry here, too, is just suffering like it is everywhere else. So anyway, in terms of employment, that is still something that I do. So I'm still connected with Tourism Smithers and trying to assist our tourism industry.
I'm curious. So when you started in tourism, like around the late 90s, you said, this position, what was tourism in general like in Smithers at that time?
Well, I think in many ways, you know, some of the product available, how do I say this? There was an excitement in product development. There were lots of young companies. There were lots of very established companies. And Smithers, you know, the commercial hunting sector and the commercial angling sector are well established. They've been there for decades. They're good, solid businesses that kind of know what they're doing. They're there. Whether people notice them or not, they're there in the background every year. But there was the kind of the creation of the adventure tour sector as well. So about that time, you know, there was a business called Take a Hike Tours. Tony Harris had purchased a property up around McDowell Lake and was developing ski trails and a hiking business. There was, you know, float plane sightseeing. There was rafting companies. We had a canoe company where we were doing that. So there was this real kind of excitement over the adventure tourism sector. And it was easier then, you know, for the good or bad, regulation happens. And when things are a bit of a frontier, people get excited with ideas and they just jump in and they try them. Some work, some don't. And then once a sector becomes established, of course, for reasons we understand, even if we don't like them, regulation follows. And so it's a little more difficult for some of those businesses to start. So in some ways, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, it felt like more things were being created more quickly. It just isn't possible now to do that the same way. If you have an idea, you have to fit, you have to get insurance, you have to have a business plan. Those things aren't bad, but they do get in the way sometimes of someone who's got a really good idea and not a lot of capital. So it was exciting. But now I would have to say, you know, if we went back just to before the pandemic, because that changed everything, I think we were feeling pretty good about things. You know, we have an established tourism industry. In Smithers, people have found the things where the customers come. And again, commercial hunting and commercial angling are the backbone. But we have a good accommodation sector. Smithers itself provides something for visitors that often they don't know about until they get here. You know, it's something I am quite proud of. We have a beautiful community. Some of that's happenstance. We have a beautiful mountain as our backdrop. We're on the banks of the Bulkley River, which is world-renowned for steelhead and salmon. So we have a lot of things going for us. But the community over time built something that was beautiful as well. You know, those that came before us put effort into downtown. They tried to make it beautiful. They tried to make it stand out, and they were successful. And so we have that as well. When people come here and they wander downtown and they find the quality of service and product they find, well, that they take that with them. And so I'm always, you know, I'm touched and I'm proud of what our community has done. I hear it from visitors. I hear it from those who come in other industries as well. You know, they come here and they, you know, they maybe go downtown on a lark and then they're like, oh my goodness, like I found all these amazing things. And part of that is the people who own those businesses, that the owners are inside. You know, if you walk into one of those shops, for the most part, you're going to find the owner and you're going to get their passion and their zest for community and what they do. And that's different than walking into, you know, a bigger store in the city. So I just feel we're so fortunate here. And so I think our tourism industry was doing really well. I mean, the community was doing well, but the tourism sector was doing well. It was growing. Now we'll be in recovery, like everyone else. But tourism especially will be in recovery for a few years. You know, to get back to where we were in 2019 is going to be a long haul.
So I guess what other positions have you had in tourism?
Well, that's it. You know, I think, although what I've learned, and it's, you know, maybe stating what's just obvious is, you know, connections are everything. So when I started, of course, the whole notion of doing marketing on, you know, marketing our community and the product to the world, whatever that means, was kind of, that was a tough slog to figure out what it meant. How far does our money go? Not very far. But you work with others, you find others in your nearby communities who are doing similar work, rely on the regional tourism organization and the provincial tourism organization. You realize that they want you to be successful too, so you start to build these allegiances. You know, 2010, the Olympics in Vancouver created opportunity for British Columbia, including our community. And that, I guess, is what I mean by connections. So we had someone on Smitherstown Council then, Joanne Groves, who was very interested in what was happening with the Olympics and what could be the connections to Smithers. And so she made sure that we were connected and we were able to travel to, you know, all the education opportunities that the Olympic Committee provided. They didn't want it to be Vancouver's games. They wanted it to be the province's games, Canada's games. And so education was afforded to all of us. There was funding to assist our sport organizations, you know, and so it was a great learning opportunity for us as well. And we were able to have the torch come through Smithers. So we were part of that, the torch relay. And so, you know, from that it's connections. So who do you know? So I guess I realized the value of just always showing up, you know, go to the provincial meetings. Yes, we're a small part of the pond, but go there and meet the people and realize that they're willing to help you as well. This is so cliche now in the pandemic, but we truly are in it together. And if BC is going to be successful as a tourism destination, then it needs other communities to back up Vancouver. Pre-pandemic, Vancouver was overflowing. It can no longer support all the visitors that wanted to go there. So BC can't be successful if there's not other great places that visitors want to go. So connections matter. So being, you know, For a while I was on the provincial Nordic marketing board because we have a Nordic center here that's fabulous. And, you know, it's got much to offer. I currently am part of the BC Destination Marketing Association. It's a long title, BC Destination Marketing Organization Association. I'm on that board and have been for a few years. So it's about other people who do the same work I do. What are our common challenges? How do we work with the province and our provincial organizations to make sure that things make sense, not just in the big tourism destinations, but for all of us? I've been on the board for the Northern BC Tourism Association for far too long. But you know, those connections matter to this community, I think, that first of all, it makes me aware of what's going on and it enables me to do my very best to make sure other people are aware of what we have and that, you know, the people who work with me will know that I have often said in those meetings that a dollar earned by a hotel in Smithers is just as important as a dollar earned by a hotel in Vancouver. They're the same. The owners want to be successful just the same. And so it's incumbent upon us and our own communities to bring that message forward, to be champions for our communities and the businesses that work so hard. It is that piece about we're all working together. And I believe so deeply in this community that it feels like a privilege to be able to carry that message out. And again, those that know me won't be surprised by that. But my heart lives here and I want this community to be successful. And so anytime I've been able to take that message, I'm happy to do so. And it mostly has been tourism connected, but not only tourism connected.
Great. I feel like you've just touched on this a little bit, I think, but how did you transition, I guess, from tourism into politics?
That's really funny. I read a book a few years ago about saying that no politician ever wanted to be a politician. That's probably not actually true. There's probably a few, but I would say that's true for me. I love Smithers. I am about Smithers. I love this community. And many years prior to making the decision to run for council, people had, you know, they toss it your way, like, oh, why don't you run for councillor? Oh, you know, there's an election coming up. Why don't you think about that? And very easily, the answer was always like, absolutely not. But then what changed that? In 2013, Smithers celebrated its centennial.
Okay, and we have returned.
Okay. So I'll just try to pick it up. The piece about being asked to consider running for council. So the tangent to that, but it is the piece that actually got me to think about it more seriously, was our centennial. So in 2013, Smithers celebrated 100 years since its kind of rustic formation, not its incorporation, but since it actually started. And a couple of years prior, the same counselor that I had mentioned before, Joanne Groves, started looking around in the community for organizations and people to volunteer to organize the centennial celebration. And she'd asked many people, all of whom said no, and then she asked me and I said no as well. And finally she said, well, can you just set up a meeting and we'll get people to come to the meeting and then we'll figure it out. And it's like, okay, I'll do one meeting. So I helped organize a meeting, and it was at the Aspen. And about 30 people came, I think. And there was kind of a basic question. It's like, so this was in 2011, like 2 years ahead of the centennial. And there was a question is, you know, do we want to do it? And do you want to help? But it started with an introduction. And so we just went around the room. And it kind of went like this. People would say, well, I came to Smithers 20 years ago for a weekend, and I stayed. I came to Smithers 35 years ago for a holiday, and I loved it, so I came back. And the whole room went like that. And I think there were only one or two of us in the room that had been here for our lives. And so there was an excitement in the room. And by the time we got done, it was clear we were going to do a centennial. And I was still pretty sure I wasn't going to be involved. However, a bunch of lobbying started. And at the end, I ended up being the co-chair of the centennial with a gentleman, David McKenzie, who was the chair of the museum board for a long time. He was also on the tourism committee, and he was the manager of the Sandman Inn for a while. So anyway, we worked on that for a couple of years. We had a spectacular centennial. And I'm just going to skip over it because the question was about politics. And so at the end of the centennial, I had been doing this volunteer job for a couple of years, and I was really tired. It was so much fun, but I was done. And I had said to myself in the year 2014, I'm not going to volunteer for anything. I'm going to give myself a year without it. And I was pretty good about it. And then it was also the election year for local government, and people just started saying to me, why don't you think about running for council? Why don't you think about running for council? And it just became more. And then our former mayor, Taylor Backrack, and I had a meeting one day and a dinner, and he sort of suggested it as well. And it's like, okay, this is starting to come more frequently. And then the final was just this senior fellow who saw me outside the post office, Mr. Person, Ev Person, and who was quite a bit taller than me, and he was close to me, and he was sort of looking down, and fairly serious, and he's like, so, are you going to run for council? And I looked at him and said, like, well, do you think I should? He said, yes. And I said, why? Like, why should I run? And he said, well, you're kind of level-headed, and I think you could see both sides of an issue, and I just think you should. And I've got to say, he was the one who tipped me over. And so that was, I don't know, probably in the summer before the election. And I kind of decided at that point, okay, I'm going to run for council. And so I did. So it was just, you know, it's a building up of people, I guess, who think you can and who have confidence in you. And they just keep nudging you a little bit until finally, I guess you would either make the decision, absolutely not, and stop talking to me, or, well, okay, maybe I could. So that was really, you know, so it wasn't something where I'd longed to be on council. It was just a sense of, you know, as I've said before, I haven't been very strategic about the things I've done in my life, but things tend to work out, you know, trying to pay attention when the right door is opening and maybe there's something that you can do or something that will be fulfilling to you. And I think that was one of those things. So I ran in 2014 and I was elected to council.
Great. I guess, what did you run on? What sort of platform did you have?
You know, it's so funny. Even the media asked me, like, what's your agenda? And I can honestly say I did not have one. I don't know how else to say this. I'm all about Smithers. And so people had asked me to run because they thought I had something to give. I didn't have a something I needed to do. I didn't have a chip on my shoulder about something that had been done wrong. It was a community, is a community that I care about. And if I can contribute energy to making it a better place or at least ensuring nothing goes wrong, then I'm interested in doing that. But I did not run in 2014 on a platform. I didn't have one. It was just, you know, I think I have demonstrated to community, I am about this place. I'm willing to work at it. And if elected, I'll just apply my energy to working on council. And that was it.
Great. And then what did you do well on council? What sort of projects were you involved with?
Oh, you know, that first term seems so long ago. What did we work on? I guess early on, when we were trying to figure out what our strategic priorities would be, the thing that tugged at me was the development at Central Park. I'm still ever hopeful we'll be able to come up with a Central Park plan that honors this town, that is the quality of this town. And so we started we put Central Park Plan on our priorities, and part of that was then dealing with, you know, what we didn't call, maybe there's a better word, but it's kind of the tenants of our building. So the library, the gallery, the museum, and the visitor center are key tenants in our public buildings. And talking to them about whether or not we would have it within us to create what we called then a cultural center. And that definitely spoke to me. So I put energy into that. At the end, the decision was made by council. Of course, it was a long time and some research that went into it. The decision finally made by council was the first step would be to support a combined library gallery project on the property across from Town Hall that currently houses the library. And yeah, we put energy into that. And of course, we weren't successful with the initial grant. It's carried over as a priority into the current council. And so still ever hopeful we'll do that. But in my heart of hearts, I would love to get to Central Park. What I've learned in a community our size is there's only so many things we can do at the same time. I used to think we could do everything at the same time. But, you know, we're still a small community. And even though we do have a staff, it's a staff that's well-resourced. Like, they got work. We're not looking for things for them to do. So if we could get the grant for the library gallery, there's a grant application out there now, and we were able to move that project forward. I'm hoping that in the community, we would then be able to turn our attention to Central Park and what that could look like for the future of this town. As you know, we still have key organizations that are housed in the Central Park building. So the museum especially is in need of a permanent and a more secure home for the work it does. We have a visitor center that, you know, the staff and the operation of the visitor center are very good. The building doesn't quite add up to what they do. And we have this beautiful piece of property in the center of town where we could create something, again, that honors this community. So whether it included, you know, some sculpted version of recreation, whether it is an indoor-outdoor museum, indoor-outdoor visitor center. I mean, the sky's the limit in what we would create, but I just realized we're not going to get there until we deal successfully with a library gallery project. So that truly, that's on my agenda, is to try to help get that project move forward. It's time, it's well past time. And yeah, so we need to do that before we can move on to other big projects. And of course, the pandemic changes everything. Changes people's priorities, right? We have to get through that first.
Don't worry. I'll ask about the pandemic a little later. Don't worry. So then how did you go from council to mayor? What was that process?
Well, those are just circumstances, right? So at the end of the first term, so our term was up in 2018, I made the decision to run for a second term as counselor. And our former mayor, Taylor Backrack, ran as mayor and was elected. And so we settled in. Then circumstances. Not long after that, and I've lost the timeline, but it was clear there was going to be a federal election. Our MP of the day, Nathan Cullen, announced that he would be stepping down. And that just created, you know, a ripple in the water. Taylor Backrack started to consider whether or not he would want to run as the MP. He ran as the nominee for the New Democrats in this riding and then began working on that. He took a leave from his job. I was the deputy mayor, so when he wasn't there, I was filling in his role. Then he was elected, then he resigned, and so it just rolled. I mean, I was in the acting mayor, deputy mayor position at the time, so I continued to do it. We had different procedural things that held up holding a by-election immediately. Then a by-election was called, then the pandemic, the by-election was canceled. So it was just a long process. So I was in the role of acting mayor for about a year before the by-election was called. By then I had decided, I decided fairly early on. I really enjoyed working with Taylor as mayor, and I would have been content to stay on council with Taylor as mayor. And maybe if the term had ended, I might have decided not to run again. But at the time, I was committed to being on council, and the choice had to be made. Do I want to just stay in the councilor role and take what may in terms of who will be sitting in the mayor's chair? Or if I'm going to be on council, do I want to attempt to hold that seat myself? And rather than having to work under the direction of someone who I don't know and who I might have loved working with, but I might not? Or do I want to just put myself out there and say, if I'm going to be here, that's the role I would like to have, and I made that choice. So I decided that if I was going to stay on council midterm with a by-election coming up, I was going to try for mayor, and that's how that happened. Once again, it wasn't in the great scheme of things for me, but it's where we got to.
Great. Do you have any sort of platform you ran on for that election?
You know, that's probably colored in great part by what was happening at that time. And you said you were going to ask about the pandemic, but it is the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so that affected my thinking. The election was called in August. The by-election was called in August. So I resigned from council in August. So I had about 3 months until the election. But up until that time, from March until August, the pandemic affected my every day. Everyone at the town was working flat out, and not just the town. Throughout many, many businesses and agencies, people were working flat out. And I had learned in a new way what it means to work with people. You know, I think early on, you just get up in the morning and you wait to see what your job is that day. What's not working right? What is the opportunity that the province is casting your way? Because they were all trying to help as well. So what's happening today? What do we need to do today? And so you're working with your eyes wide open, hopefully with your heart wide open, to see what are the challenges and what are the opportunities. And it was completely astonishing. We held roundtables, virtual roundtables, and there were times where in the roundtable, someone would describe a problem, and by the end of the roundtable, the path forward was already being carved out. People were so responsive, so creative, so committed to getting through things together, that by the time it was time to campaign in the by-election, that was a huge part of my thinking, because we were still in the we are still in the pandemic. But it wasn't so much about what are the big projects coming forward. It's about what's happening right now in our community. So one can hold the future vision, because we'll get back there. But I believe so firmly in that this is about working together. This is about recognizing where are the dilemmas in our community and what collectively do we do together. So I think by the time the by-election started, I wasn't on championing a project. I'm still holding fast for the library gallery. It's not gone away. We have things we need to do. Regular maintenance work. We need to work on our infrastructure. We need to work on the assets. All those things are an underpinning. But the day-to-day is about recognizing where are the challenges in our community and what can we do as our local elected officials to make sure if we have a gap, we're connecting it back up the food chain to the province or the federal government. It's again about those relationships and working together. So in the by-election, I think that's the message I tried to hold. This is not the time to be throwing stones. This is not the time to be creating something brand new. This is about just getting the work done. You know, and there were other messages through the campaign as well, but that's where I was. It's about, let's stay calm, folks. Let's recognize this is an amazing community. We have all kinds of attributes and we're going to get through. But what we have to do is kind of just keep your eyes and ears open, look for the gaps and work together. So again, I would have to say in this election, I didn't come at it with a, oh boy, here's what we're going to do. It's just not the time. And I think we have to recognize the time that we live in and, you know, shoulder together.
Great. And I guess, well, clearly you were elected, but what was the general response to that message?
Well, overall, I think I had good feedback. Of course, you don't only get good feedback. There were people that had different ideas. They wanted, you know, they had different approach. But I guess I only live in my skin, and others can chart their own path. I made a decision that I would stay in my own skin and in my own messaging for the by-election. I don't want to be anywhere else. And, you know, I was so fortunate in that there were a few people that helped me and joined with me that I could bounce ideas off. And I think at the end of the day, the thing that held true is everyone just kept saying to me, just be who you are. And that's really all I can be. It's all I have to offer. I have to offer my energy, my willingness to work, and that's really it. So I think that's all I offered.
Great. So I think you've already talked about this a lot, but I was going to ask, what are some of the challenges you faced in politics? Obviously, you talked about the pandemic, which is the big one. And you talked about the library gallery building. Is there anything else? Like any other challenges, projects, or anything like that?
Do you mean over the entire time I've been in local government? Well, there's key learnings for sure. When I first got elected, you know, I could see at the early, my first, you know, several council meetings, maybe the first few months, I don't really know anymore. But I used to say you could see the scars that other councillors wore. Certain topics would come up, issues, points of decision making, and you could see people visibly react to that. You know, obviously something had happened. This particular issue has history, and people are tentative. You can tell there's been something has happened. And then, of course, we all get our own. You know, so issues emerge where you take one side of a position or another. There's a public up, whatever, you know, there's an upswelling. People who think you're wrong. We live in a day of social media. So if people don't think you're right, you're going to hear about it really quickly. And so, I mean, I have those too. You know, there's things that, you know, where I landed on one side of an issue and some number of the public were on another side and there's a reaction to that. And you just start to wear your own scars. And you can tell I'm wearing them because I'm reluctant to even describe them. But, you know, for one, I mean, it seems mundane now, but, you know, it's truly the sign bylaw. I really, really care what Smithers looks like downtown. I'm not a designer. I'm not an artist. I'm not the person who holds that kind of detail. But there are those that aspire high and there are those that don't. And I think I would like the entire town, but certainly that downtown core, to continue to aspire high. And we had guidelines and Alpine theme and things that helped to contrive a certain aesthetic downtown. And I think it's important. And, you know, there was an issue early on where there was challenges and I kind of dug in my heels where I thought they need to be dug in. Not alone, other people on council did too. And, you know, some of us took a beating, the mayor took a beating as well. And, you know, you start to just develop your own little wounds, they scar over. And a few years go by, right, and you think, someone asked me about this the other day, sometimes it still hurts, but it doesn't hurt as much. You get a bit more immune to social media commentary. And I think at the end of the day, we have to be true to ourselves. So if I think something is the right thing to do, I just do. And we sit at a table of seven, and I've heard many times, but we trust the wisdom of the table. You state your position, you can try to argue your position, but the will of the group will be the will of the group, and you win some, you lose some. And again, I've forgotten exactly where we started from here. So if I've lost the bouncing ball, please just bring me back to it.
That was perfect.
Okay.
I guess my next question about politics. Can you talk about the relationship between like municipal government in Smithers and other towns in the area, whether it be Telqua or Whitsett or Hazelton?
Just whether or not we have good relationships, you mean?
Yeah, like what does that relationship look like? Is it very, very separate? Do you work together on certain projects and things like that?
I'd have to say it's not always the same. I don't have the sense that any of those relationships are bad. I think sometimes we make more effort to communicate with one another than other times. Sometimes that's prompted just by good thinking, like, hey, we should call them up and see what's happening. Again, in my first term, we made effort to physically get together, just once, but to go, you know, go to our neighboring town and have dinner with the council, just to chat. And this last 4 years, for all kinds of reasons, has not gone that way. It's not even 4 years, it's only 2 years in this term. There's not been a time where everything has seemed really smooth and flowing, where it felt like there's a lot of extra time to kind of create these nice social interactions. But I don't have the sense that the relationships are bad or strained. From Smithers to Vanderhoof, we also see each other at least, you know, some of us see each other at the regional district table. All councillors are represented at the regional district, so you have that kind of connection as well. I phone people, they phone me. So this probably doesn't connect directly to all the counselors, but at the levels of mayors, we phone each other up, sometimes just to say hi, sometimes to say, hey, this is what's on my plate. What do you do? Or how did you get through it? So there's emails and text messages. For female mayors, there are also groups or sort of social groups about, you know, sort of Northern female mayors or BC female mayors. I'm not sure if that exists for the male mayors or not, but it does exist for the females, where you can just, again, they're just, here's my question or my issue. Anybody got any ideas for me? So across the North, though, I don't have any particular sense of strain. I think the relationships are generally positive. If, you know, I would have to say probably if sometimes ignored in view of what each of us is doing in our own home front, mm-hmm. but I would not hesitate to phone any of the other mayors if I had a question.
Great. So I believe, correct me if I'm wrong here, you were the second female mayor of Smithers?
Yeah.
What is that like? Like, how does that feel?
You know, I try not to spend a lot of time there, honestly, because I just like to think about, you know, individuals' capacity. I'd be lying if I said I never thought about it. Certainly during the election, it was pointed out. People wondered if I would be the first female mayor. I do remember Carol Young back in the time when I sat in the gallery. You know, Carol was a counselor and a mayor of the community, and she was a very capable, dedicated woman. So I remember that. And there were other women on council who did, you know, had strong roles and represented community well. So I'm aware of it, but I don't want to think about it too much. I hope that I'm able to just perform well. I don't want that to be a real factor in how I'm viewed. At the same time, I'm aware there are differences. And so if I am able to provide anything to other women who are thinking that they would like a life in whatever public role, I would be delighted if I had something to share. I have watched young women talk about their challenges when they try to get into not just politicians' roles, but other roles. And the challenges are still there. You know, it's unfortunate, but they are there. I've listened to women who have been in politics for 40 years or 50 years describe their early days of what it was like to be on council when it was viewed that you probably shouldn't be there and you ought to be at home. So things have changed. I don't get any sense that people don't think it's appropriate for a woman to be either on council or the mayor or any other political role. And yet at the same time, there are still some challenges that I see for women that are a bit harder. You know, society still leaves women as primary caregivers. And so a woman who has young children is going to have different challenges, not just in the public life, but in any role. You know, we've had men on council who have been primary caregivers with children as well. They experience challenges too. And so somehow I think it's really about getting to a point where we just support each other. You know, if we're going to have a future society, someone's going to have children and we're going to collectively rear them, and we have to make room for that. And if there are different challenges that people are experiencing in different phases of their life, well, that's just the way it is. And we need to honor people at all parts of their life. So we need to make room for them. And so, yeah, I hope that, you know, being female isn't the predominant factor. I'm hoping competence and caring are. But we have to pay attention to challenges that people feel if they're singled out, so that we erode those barriers and that people are able to offer up their good energy and their creativity to contribute to society in whichever role they want to.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that. I think that is, that's essentially my last question from politics. You kind of answered them all through other questions here. Is there anything else about your experiences in politics that you wanted to talk about today?
My mind's just kind of spinning, so no, I think I'm okay.
Sure. Okay, so the last question, last section, I guess, just some more fun questions. How do you think Smithers has changed in all of your time here? Hmm. You've talked about this in various ways, but if you have any other thoughts.
Well, it's funny, but, you know, Smithers has changed, and yet in essential ways, I think it's very much similar to when I was a young adult. I'm going to use... The things that make that give Smithers strength, I think, are variances. You know, it's a community that, for the most part, has not been run by a single sector. We're not a one-horse town, and that gives a community strength. And I think that was there when I was a young adult, and it's there now. Having a variety of business sectors, having people with diverse thought, having a strong academic sector in the community, you know, having a hospital in our community, having a college in our community, having the BV Center in our community, having an airport. All of those things have contributed to a strength of community that has been there my entire life. Variety just matters. Variety of thought, variety of work, variety of landscape. And so that when there are challenges in the broader community, our community has been has always managed to get through pretty well. You know, not every individual in the community, but the community. And so in that way, I think, you know, that that bit of personality has been there for a long time, and I think it's really important. And as a community, we need to work to preserve that. This would be a much different community if we were, you know, one of the storybook communities with the big mill or the big mine or the big something, where someone entity holds an uneven amount of sway over decision making. So that, I think, has been a strength in this community for a long time. You know, the aesthetic of the community has been here my whole life. Of course, there was a change downtown in about 1980, I think it was, where the downtown was recreated. But the major aesthetic of the community remains. I mean, we have a gorgeous mountain rising at one end, and if we walk a little further, we end up at the beautiful river. We see the Babine. So it's there's a strong aesthetic in the community that affects it, I think. You know, it brings out the arts, it brings out the musicians. You can't walk outside really and be uninspired. And so there's a creative soul in the community that's alive and well, and I think it's been, you know, maybe it's getting stronger, I don't know, but it's alive and thriving, and it's a part of who we are. So there's the aesthetic, there's the mix of business in the community, there's good transportation, you know, that allows people a freedom of knowing that they can come and go. People can live here and work somewhere else. So, you know, so it has changed. You know, the community matures, of course, times change. But at the same time, those essential pieces of community, I feel, have been here my lifetime. And I hope we hang on to them. You know, that mix, that strength of people, what they do for a living. And it can be a platform for being more of that. We do have challenges as a community. It's not Camelot. It's not the perfect place. But together we have the capacity to work on our challenges and keep inching our community into being an always better community.
That's a very good answer. Thank you. I guess this kind of brings me to another one. Do you have any other musings or thoughts about life in Smithers today?
It is hard for me to be objective about this community. This is just a really great place. You know, we've got seniors that are out and about going for coffee, that are walking. And, you know, things are colored by the pandemic. I can't shake that. You know, some of the things that were so fun to see a year ago, we don't see them the same way. People aren't out and about. They're not in close proximity. But that heart of the community still lives. You know, people in the parks playing with their children, people being able to ride their bikes and roll their skateboards, even though they're annoying other people, the fact that they're downtown, that people are just living, that there's an energy that gets people out and about. You know, I think that's dear in my heart. The phrase, there's just something about Smithers. I've heard that from people who have come from other parts, who are visiting for a day or spent here maybe a week. There's something attractive about the community. So again, it's the aesthetic, but it's the people. It's the culture of community. And if we keep that in the forefront, we'll always be that. you know, we need to celebrate all the good things, work on the bad things, but we're so lucky here. We have this big, beautiful valley where food can be produced, where we're able to find a way to earn a living, where we can celebrate arts, where we can, if we're on our game, take care of people who need a little help. We have enough richness in community, both in, you know, monetary or economic richness, but plus human richness to take care of people. And I just think that's the best of this community. And if we keep our eye on the best and being the best, then we'll get there. And, you know, again, it sounds maybe Pollyanna-ish, but we can do all kinds of things. We just have to want to and allow people bad days so that they can, you know, have our little fits. But on balance, this community is just filled with really cool people and all kinds of potential. And I just see that continuing.
Great. I guess my next question here. What does a Friday night look like for you? And how has that changed, let's say, when you were 21, 31? How has that changed?
Well, they're pretty bleak now.
Or we can say last year.
Okay.
That makes it a little easier.
Pre-pandemic. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, probably different in terms of the amount of people I might socialize with. Certainly when I was younger, Friday nights and Saturdays, it's about getting together, either, you know, when you're single, finding people to go out with, or when you're in a relationship, getting together with other people and, you know, having a party or going on an outing or maybe going camping. You know, for the last few years, you know, a few good girlfriends, having a glass of wine on a Friday night, sharing laughs and being relaxed. You know, so in many ways, maybe the people have changed, but the essence of being able to celebrate the end of the week, laugh with people or cry with people, depending on how your week has gone, I think that's the same. You know, so sometimes it was maybe 10 people and sometimes it was 2 people or maybe just one good friend. But I think the essence is the same, you know, still celebrate together.
Okay, great. And my last question is there anything else you want to talk about? Any topics that we only just touched on or didn't talk about at all that you want to go into?
I don't think so. You know, I would leave it to you if there's, I mean, I do feel like I've rambled a great deal. And so if it turns out that there's something else, just let me know. And otherwise, I think I'll just leave it with you.
Okay. Well, I think this went very well. Thank you very much. And I will end the recording here.